Although we're a history podcast and we have dealt in detail with the historical facts of the war, as a Jewish podcast, we also have a shared responsibility to not only educate, but to uplift one another. After all, our history binds us together. We started off this series of Yishmael vs. Yisrael by quoting the Rambam, how important it is to be part of a national or communal tzara. Every Jew around the world, no matter what sect they belong to or level of Yiddishkeit they are on, has been davening for the soldiers and for all the Jews affected by this terrible war since Simchas Torah. A couple of weeks ago, we had Elchanan Danino in the studio, and it's for the same reason that we're doing this episode. When we daven for the safety and well-being of Jews going through hardship and suffering, if these episodes increase the kavana and intensity of our tefillahs by hearing the personal tribulations and what they're going through, we thought that would be worth it. This podcast is a personal experience, as you'll hear. He couldn't say everything, but it'll definitely give you a taste of what he went through. Jonah is currently back home, but there are currently, as we speak, tens and tens of thousands of Jews who are in the middle of life-threatening battles, and giving the mic to a soldier will hopefully inspire people to daven for the well-being of all of Klal Yisrael. On to the podcast. Welcome to History for the Curious. I'm Menno Reisner, and I host the internationally renowned lecturer, dynamic historian, and tour guide, Rabbi Aubrey Hirsch. Experience our history, confront dilemmas, and reveal the untold stories of 3,000 years of Jewish heritage, from Paris to Cairo, from the Russian Tsar to Maimonides, and from the Sinai Revelation to the French Revolution. Join the fastest growing Jewish history podcast in the world by subscribing to this channel and discovering the events that have shaped us into who we are today. Last week's interview with Douglas Murray was extremely popular, having had hundreds of thousands of listens within the first few days. And I just wanted to thank his team again for making it happen. If you haven't seen it, make sure you check it out. We have had many episodes in the past which have been sponsored in Nishmas or in memory of a loved one, and we've now opened the opportunity for commercial sponsorships too. This week's sponsor is Starguest, headed by Aria Wagner. He has created an exclusive Pesach program in the Kempinski Hotel in Engelberg in Switzerland, which of course has beautiful surroundings and fine catering. And if you go, you will have the honor of being able to hear Rabbi Hirsch live, who is scholar in residence there for the entire Pesach. For more details, please email luxurykosher@gmail.com. And for all future sponsorship opportunities, please do email podcasts@jd.org.uk.
Okay, so I wanted to introduce the podcast with both a perspective on history and a retrospective, perhaps, on many of the narratives we have covered. Secular history is often, if not always, the description and actual records of the powerful, the rulers, the nations. You know, think about the secular history that you were taught in school. How many names do you know from the past who were not royalty or generals or political leaders, especially before the 19th century? It's true the peasants could neither read nor write in the main, and they lived rather sedentary lives, but there were many of the people who surrounded the powerful who are never mentioned, and certainly not by name. Jewish history doesn't lose sight of individuals, because people make a difference. I make a difference. And sometimes the effect of one individual can be traced in hindsight. The Talmud in Gittin tells us that it is the humility of Zechariah ben Avkulus which destroyed the temple. Now, we don't mean that he bears the responsibility of all the suffering and the last 2,000 years of exile, but that he was a catalyst, one individual. Even though he's not a famous Tana and mentioned perhaps only five times in all of Shas, and that's why we preserve halachic responsa, tshuvas, not just for their pure halachic impact, but for the story of the individual contained within them. Which secular society has questions which were asked by ordinary individuals 700 years ago? History as Jews read it is not just about trends and economic waves. And closer to our time period, There is a prison cell in Theresienstadt in the smaller fortress, which is about an hour's drive north of Prague, which I often take groups to. The jail itself is empty, and there is nothing there that explains what it was used for or who was there, but it was actually the cell of Gavrilo Princip. Under 18 years old at the time, he was responsible for the assassination in 1914 of the Archduke Ferdinand of Austria, who was neither a king nor a ruler, but this death set into motion a series of events that would ultimately take the lives of almost 50 million people. Gavrilo Princip is that catalyst, right? Just think about the responsibility for a moment. The immediate effect of his actions was World War I with 14 million victims, and arguably World War II was the outcome from the first. And yet most people have never heard of him, and there is no signage raising that point over there in Theresien, and nothing tells us what happened as a result, because secular history doesn't really have time for individuals who don't fit into the general trends of historical movements. And, of course, this has become much worse in the last 20 years, where not only do they not teach history as such, they are constantly revising old history to fit into present-day trends. So, you know, statues and paintings of people are being taken down across the Western world because history has to fit in with modern thinking. Now, the Jewish view of how to read history is threefold. Firstly, the individual matters. Secondly, the details matter, the concept of Hashgacha Pratis. And thirdly, that there is an overall plan and goal to history. In fact, from our Jewish perspective, one of the tragedies of this current conflict in Israel is that there is not enough time for the individual or the details. There isn't enough time to mourn each of the individuals and not enough bandwidth to see the details. Although, I guess in the third area, I think many do see this conflict as having Jewish and spiritual causes, outcomes, rather than just the political ones, even for many secular Jews. And the concept of how to view history comes to the fore this Shabbos. We are given, generally, six constant things to remember, sheish zechiris. They are the Exodus from Egypt, the giving of the Torah on Sinai, the golden calf, Miriam and the incident with Moshe and Aaron, Amalek and Shabbos. Three of them collide on Shabbos Zachar. A, leaving Egypt, which is a daily obligation. B, Shabbos, which is a weekly Zachar. And C, Amalek, which is an annual remembrance. The Exodus informs us of our past, where and when we were formed. Shabbos leads us to the goal of the future, Me'ein Olam Haba. And Amalek reminds us of the constant that will accompany us throughout history, anti-Semitism. And that, in turn, will remind us of our purpose and that we are chosen and that we are different. We need to be reminded that we are extremists, extremists towards ourselves, with ultimate non-negotiable values for which we will give up our lives and which have endured for 3,000 years, despite the best attempts of Amalek to destroy them and us. Evil will always exist. And as I mentioned in the Douglas Murray interview last week, anti-Semitism is a constant. It reinvents itself to fit the circumstances and age. And the West is a mess, precisely because it refuses to believe that there are extremists, because it cannot believe in absolutes, because the West nowadays lives basically without memory of the past. It lives in the present. You know, news is of interest just for a few hours, at best 24 hours, after which it simply fades away. The West is too short-sighted to see that without anchors, without memories, we are adrift. We basically have no purpose. It's all about the next TikTok video. The last one is long gone. And there's one last connected point to all of this, which originates in a passage in the Megillah that we don't necessarily define or think about, but which is an instruction for future centuries in history. At one stage, towards the end of chapter 4, Mordechai begs Esther to get an audience with the king in order to save the Jewish people. Esther responds by saying, it's simply too dangerous. She's likely to lose her life if she tries at that point. Now, what should Mordechai's response to her have been? We would have expected him to say, you know, Esther, You're right, it's dangerous, and you might lose your life in the process, but the Jewish people need you, all of them. Instead, he responds by saying, oh, you don't want to do it? That's fine, I'll find somebody else to do it. Revach v'hatzala yamid le'yehudim mimokim acher. They will be saved anyway. Which is astonishing. I mean, if you didn't need her to sacrifice her life, then why give her all this grief? And there is another question. Given that the reason for the Purim decree, a decree from heaven, was the result of the Jews spending too much of their time involved in Persian culture and in the corridors of power, hobnobbing in the king's court during the king's party, if that was the cause of the decree, then the solution lies in moving away from that and Dafka having a spiritual plan. So why did Mordechai even suggest to Esther that she takes the diplomatic route to solve the problem? The entire problem came about because of too much involvement, and therefore the solution couldn't have been there, surely. The answer is, it's perfectly valid to use any means to overturn the decree, as long as the motive, the ideology to do so is religious, as long as the motivating factor is the Jewish people and Mesiras Nefesh for the Klal. But the moment Esther responds by saying, well, you know, not now, maybe I can get to the king at a different time, at the opening of parliament or during the presidential elections, at that point, Mordechai says, oh, forget it. The diplomatic route helps overturn a gezeira if there is complete focus on it being a Jewish problem with a Jewish solution. And then what does Esther respond to that at that point? She says, you're right, absolutely. You know what we should do? Fast for 3 days. And on the basis of that, on the back of that, I will enter into the king's presence. And yes, maybe I will lose my life, kasha of oddity, but I will have done so without losing sight that I am working for the sake of the Jewish people. In this week's podcast, we interview a religious soldier who fought in Gaza, not for the military perspective or to understand the theatre of war in Gaza, but to see the individual and try and achieve something individually to take away.
We have the honour of welcoming to the studio today a very special guest, Yona Pinchas Gedalia ben Sarachana. The reason why we're not going to say his name is for obvious reasons. He served in the military in Gaza, and it's just best if we keep that to ourselves. He is from London originally. He's just come back from 8 weeks in Gaza fighting on the front lines, and he's currently in our studio to share some of his experiences. Yona has known Rabbi Hirsch for many years. I've just had the pleasure of meeting you now. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak with us and to share your experience with our listeners.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me in.
So could we just start by asking right from the beginning, how soon after Shmini Atzeres were you called up, and was your unit given specific plans? I mean, obviously, if you're allowed to share any of this, I'm sure there's certain sensitive things throughout the entire podcast that you won't be able to, but whatever you can share.
Sure. So I'll start off on Shmini Atzeres itself. I remember we were all, you know, we had the whole family around for lunch, and suddenly we started getting rumors, and already in Shul we had heard rumors of what was going on down south. And one by one, the table just started emptying out. First it was my brother-in-law, then it was my roommate. He was with us for Chag. And slowly people just started getting called up. And I was kind of racking my brains and going a bit crazy because I hadn't been called. I hadn't, you know, I'd checked my phone, but I hadn't got anything. So it wasn't until Sunday morning, actually, on the 8th, that I got a text. And the honest truth is, I'm not signed up for Miluim officially. So because I did Lone Soldier, the path of Machal in the army, I wasn't signed up for Miluim. But when my unit got the call, they posted on the group, you know, we're getting called up, this, that, and the other. I was like, I'm coming with you. So that was on the Sunday morning. We got called up to base.
And you say you got a text. What's that text message say?
I think the first thing I saw was on our group from the army, from our active service. It was like, Miki Beloda, like, who got the text? And that was the first message I got. And it was like, after that, it was, you know, where are we going? What time do we have to get there? When's the bus? This, that, and the other, all the logistics of it. That was Sunday. And we didn't really know what we were getting called up for. My reserves is in a tanks unit. So I wasn't in a tanks unit in my active service. I was in Kfir, which is a regular infantry unit. But in Miluim, they, in the reserves, we're an infantry unit, like an armored infantry. So we're the infantry unit of this tanks unit.
Were you aware of what was going on generally, of how sort of how bad it was?
By then, I think, you know, everyone had seen the videos of what was going on down south, and people kind of assumed something was going to happen in Gaza. There was going to be someone going in. There was something was going to have to change it. I kind of assumed it wasn't going to be straight away, because if you remember, they weren't going into Gaza straight away at the beginning. They were still dealing with the south, etc. The first couple of days was a bit of a balagan in the country. So I kind of assumed we were going to be maybe training for a little bit. There was going to be some sort of period before we actually went to do a mission, kind of what happened. So we actually went from the 8th up until the beginning of December. We were actually in a training. We were, you know.
Just as a follow-up to Rabbi Hirsch's question before, what we heard as the common public outside Israel, there was total confusion in the news. The first couple of days, there was an invasion by land, sea, and air. There were maybe 500 hostages, maybe 1,000. We had absolutely no idea. Did you have clearer intelligence coming to you as part of the military? Did you sort of know the scale of it clearer than the rest of the world?
I'll be honest with you. I think, especially in, you know, the lower ranks of the military, you know, when you're not a high officer, a lot of the news you get is also from the news. Inside Gaza, perhaps we got some news a bit quicker than the actual journalists in the news would get it and the rest of the world would get it. But a lot of the stuff we're still getting from the news, especially in that training period, we were, you know, there was just as much ambiguity about what was going on for us as it was for the rest of the world, I think.
And then in December, you actually get call up.
And a week later, we went in. The tanks went in first on that Monday. And a couple of days later, we followed them as the armored infantry. And I think that was on the... That was the following... It was a week later. I think it was the 7th of December.
And are you given any instruction? I mean, obviously, it's Pikuach Nefesh, but are you given any instruction with regards to Shabbos, what you should or should not do?
So I think also being religious in the army, and I was also part of a Hezdi unit in the army, so I think it's kind of... You learn it already in your active service about in a time of war, or even just on a cov or whatever your mission is in your active service, you kind of learn the ins and outs of what you can and can't do on Shabbat. So there was no instruction, like no one came in and told us you can do this, this and that right before we went in. I think it was kind of like you kind of deal with it as it comes along. If you have a question one Shabbat, we had, you know, a couple of more learned guys with us in the unit, so we would ask them, or they would, if it was a really big question, then perhaps we'd be able to somehow get a question out to the Rav of the unit. So I think for the religious guys, it wasn't such a hassle to finding out what you can and can't do on Shabbat.
Okay, this is obviously a far more personal question. How did you summon up the courage to face each new day, knowing that you're in imminent danger and that, you know, there were fatalities every day? Obviously, there's a job to be done, but you're not there with sort of 15 years experience in the military. You're someone from London who's brought up in a very different world. How do you find within yourself that ability?
So I definitely think you go through periods. For example, the first 48 hours in Gaza is very scary. You don't know what's going to happen. You're on edge. Everyone's a little bit more on edge, a little bit more vigilant in what they're doing. And then it sort of goes down a little bit. The threat kind of hides away and it's not as evident in your face. So you're less on edge and you're less vigilant and you're less scared about what you're doing. And then it takes something both bad or good to happen. You know, either someone gets hurt or something happens that really isn't good, and then suddenly you're scared again. Coming back from that mission where you know that there's a sniper in the area and you know that anyone could be next and there's a target on your back, it was extremely scary. You know, every sprint that we had to do between buildings took courage. And there were people who needed to be kind of taken out of the shock that they were in and dragged along and kind of, you know, you can do this. We're not superhuman. We also get scared and we also get anxious and we also have emotions, and it's hard for us as well. Or something good to happen. You know, suddenly you find a house which, you know, you found a bunch of weapons in it. And the other thing I'll say is something that I told my team when we came out. Something that really gave me a lot of strength was looking at the rest of my team and thinking to myself, you know, what do I have to complain about? Like, there are people on my team with two kids at home and they've left their jobs and they've left their wives and they've left everything at home to come here and fight with me. And what have I left? I've stopped my degree for a little bit of time and I've had to push off a few things and I miss my family a little bit, but it doesn't compare to what they're going through. And that really pushed me through, because, you know, they're going through much worse and why should I complain about what I'm going through?
So you mentioned that there were motivators and I guess, powerful or perhaps evocative moments, positive and negative. Can you share any that come to mind? I know that there was one in a near empty house that you were guarding. Perhaps we could start with that one.
One really meaningful time that we had was we were clearing out a building that had to be exploded. We had to demolish the building. The combat engineers had to come in and put up a bunch of C4 to demolish this building because it was in a strategic point where they couldn't see the road. I can't remember exactly the reason why we had to demolish it. So whilst they were setting up the C4, we went into the building to kind of scout on the, like...
Right, to search.
Not search, but to kind of give them a guarding from one side of the house so that they would be protected from the western side, right. And whilst they set up the C4. Anyway, so me and four guys were in this room and we're doing rotations by the window, just, you know, keeping a guard on the road outside to make sure no one's approaching the house or approaching the building, or we don't see anyone in the windows from the buildings afar. And we're doing rotations and we're walking around this apartment that is in this building that they're demolishing. And one of my friends is looking around the apartment and he goes, what a strangely furnished apartment. There's no vessels in the kitchen, literally not a spoon, not a fork, nothing in the kitchen. In the dining room, there's two wooden beds and the rest of the apartment is completely empty. And there's a room just outside the apartment on the same floor, which is completely, you know, a regular room, seems normal, filled with clothes, the bed's made, etc. And he's like laughing about it because he's, you know, a strange apartment, like it's so weird, why would they furnish it like this? And then he takes a closer look and he's looking at the walls and he starts seeing all these drawings of a Mugen David, like children's drawing of Mugen David and all sorts of other children's drawing of people and suddenly Hebrew writing, this, that and the other. And then he notices there's a rope tied to the bed in the dining room and suddenly he looks at me and I look at him and it clicks. It's like, obviously, this is a, you know, there's been Israelis here. This is a hostage room. You know, then we did some more searching and we found a guard, Rishimat Shmira.
Right, a roster of guarding.
Yeah, a rotation of guarding in Arabic with the names and the times and et cetera. And we found, you know, Israeli Hebrew names and all sorts of writings. Like, it was a powerful moment.
What did you feel at that moment?
Some part of me felt very sad. It was like we had just missed them. Like, when were they here? It couldn't have been more than a few days ago. And another part of me felt we're chasing after them. We're getting there and, you know, maybe it won't be us specifically, but it's another unit that will find them nearby. But, you know, they're close. They're here and we'll get them in the end.
How do you deal with the tragedies that happen when you're there? You, of course, I mean, if we hear the news, then I'm sure you do. And you're inside and that sort of increases the danger, just the raw danger of being around people who want to kill you. How does that affect your unit?
So... the honest truth is that we have these little, I have a picture actually of these, of all of us sitting around these frequency radios, and like to kind of takes you back to, you know, an image from the 73 war, the 67 war. So we would listen to the radio every night and hear the news, but whenever the names came on, our officer would force us to kind of turn it down and not listen to the names. Because it is hard dealing with that kind of stuff. And suddenly you hear news of someone died in a unit and you don't hear the name. And then you're just thinking about the person that you know in that unit for days on end and thinking, could it be him? Is it him? So it's difficult. The honest truth is I find how we dealt with a lot of the things that we went through and a lot of the bad things that happened is humor is a big one. And as bad as it is to say, I mean, you have to find the way to laugh through things and kind of just... not put things to aside, but yes, put things to aside for a certain amount of time. Because if you're thinking about the tragedies that are going on and if you're thinking about the bad things that are happening to you and the people getting injured, whether it's in our unit or someone else's unit or someone that you know, then it's difficult to just keep your head on the mission and keep straight and focus on what you're doing. And it actually puts you and the rest of your team in danger because, you know, you're not focused as much and you're not giving it your 100%. I know that that's what happened to me. I found out that someone had died in a unit that my brother-in-law's in, and I didn't know what the name was, and it was just like sitting in my head for 2 days until I managed to call my mom on that Friday and, you know, make sure that he was okay. And like, I wasn't 100% for those 2 days, and it's difficult. So there's no easy answer to say, how did we deal with tragedies? Because you never deal with tragedies. You know, you kind of put things to a side, focus on what you're doing, deal with it afterwards. You know, one of the boys who in our unit, he unfortunately, you know, fell to his wounds whilst we were in there. Whilst, obviously, we didn't come out when he was killed because we were still doing our mission. We were in the thick of it. But his parents actually sent us a message and he sent us actually a few messages, a voice note at one point when someone came in to with a phone and we managed to hear the voice note that his father had played for us and a few other messages they sent us, which was really inspiring. And his dad is just an amazing person who is so strong and really is... It's inspiring to hear what he has to say after his son had been killed. And I just want to read you. Yesterday, his Yonatan is the guy who died in my unit. and his wife was pregnant at the time. And yesterday she had a child, a son, and the father sent this message to our, I think he posted it online, and I think it's just a super inspiring message that I think, if you allow me to translate a little bit of it. So he says, Mazal tov yolad ben le Yonatan, son's been born to Yonatan. He says, thank you to Hashem for giving a baby boy to Yonatan after everything that's happened. And he says the following, V'vakasha mechem am Yisrael. Don't think about what there isn't. Don't think that there's not a father, or don't think that there's not someone who's going to raise him onto his shoulders and look after this son. Don't think about there's not going to be someone who's going to dance with him on Simchat Torah. And don't think about there's not going to be someone at the bar mitzvah, or on Limud Avos and Banim, or at his wedding, or stam to have fun with him. You should think about what there is. There's a sweet baby. There's a continuation of my son Yonatan. There's a continuation of someone to love. There's someone that will remember him, someone that does remember him, and someone that will always remember him. There's someone that will say Kaddish for him. And there's Hemshech Tzmicha V'Tzikva La'am HaMufla Azeh. There's a continuation for this beautiful nation. He goes on to say all about how our enemy celebrates at the spilled blood of a Jewish child and gives out children at the death of Jews, and that we should kanu mamtikim yehudim, kanu mamtikim v'chalku l'kol mi shetiru b'derachim b'bayit b'bet sefer. You should buy sweets at the birth of a beautiful Jew and give them out, and to whoever it is, your enemies, your people who you don't have the same values as, everyone. I just think the message was that his father's giving is a really beautiful message. He was really inspiring, and that was one of the things that really got me through it. And I think for most of the people in my unit, thinking about Yonatan and thinking about how his family is going through what they're going through and are still so strong and sending us message to empower us when we should be, you know, giving nechama to them and empowering them, and they're doing the opposite. The honest truth is, the most religious guy in my unit, the most learned guy in my unit, who we would ask all the halachic questions to for the religious people, his best friend in the unit was the left-wing kibbutznik that was completely secular and atheist. And I think that's really beautiful. I loved it because I would have, you have shmirot with people, every night you have shmirot to guard on the house, etc., and you do it in partners. And one of the things that made me get really close to everyone is these two-hour shmirot every single night, or, you have multiple in a night sometimes, with different people, and they just you have the most interesting conversations, because I can be speaking 2 hours to someone who, lives in Yitzhar and learns in yeshiva all day, and then another guy who lives in a kibbutz in the Golan Heights and works on a field. But I will say, I think everyone, even the most atheist of people, get a little bit religious in Gaza,
Will they admit to it?
They'll never admit to it.
Right.
But, you'll see them sneaking on a tefillin after one day of something that really, something dangerous happened, or they were scared, and they're sneaking a prayer in here or there.
What was your religious experience like, and what was your relationship with the whole, seeing such a level of destruction, but obviously being aware that this is all part of Hashem's plan, but without understanding why?
When I think about things and I see the bad things that happen, and then I see how many more bad things could have happened. And there, it's not as obvious. I guess you have to recognize that God's hand is playing always in everything that we're doing. Someone doesn't get shot on a mission. It's not just some luck. It could have happened, and it didn't happen for a reason. At the end of the day, I'm a strong believer, and I do think God's hand has a play in everything that we do. It's just sometimes, you need to scratch away some of the dirt to find it. I will say, coming back here now, coming back to London now, I knew what was going on in the community here. I knew there was volunteering and there was lots of tefillahs, and I had already seen my name on a few of the lists that were going around in the community, and I knew there was a lot going on. And being there, you really do feel it. You do feel that you're on a mission here, you're doing a task, but there are people relying on you, and there are people thinking about you and people praying for you, and it really does give you a lot of strength. And I've said that to people here. And I think coming back here just made me realize the extent of what was going on. I had no idea the extent of what was going on, how far it had reached, and how many people were thinking of us, and how many people were volunteering. And it's been extremely inspiring coming back now and seeing what the community has done.
And do you think that in your units, let's say, especially the less religious, who are going to be perhaps less connected to things happening internationally outside of Eretz Yisrael, were they at all aware?
I do think, you know, we get the donations here and there from people in Chutz La'aretz.
Donations as in
whether
food?
whether it was equipment, it was food, it was...
Letters.
I brought back, so they sent me in a package which had a bunch of letters, also from my friends, but also from the community here. And a lot of people had written them in Hebrew and I passed them out to everyone. And I think they all kind of realized, wow, you know, if it's happening in the London community, it's happening in the New York community, and it's happening in all around the world for the Jewish communities, and they're really supporting us, and they're sending us love, and they're sending us support.
Can I move to a different type of question? How did it feel being there, knowing that your family is worrying about you, and most of the time you couldn't communicate with them? I mean, I've even come across reports that some soldiers sort of hesitated to go back for a break because they're in a mindset while they're in Gaza. When they go home, it's very different. So how did you cope with that?
So I'll give you my personal experience and what happened when I was in and coming out in the middle. So I definitely knew my family was worrying about me. My mom, and my mom's, you know, she is a Yiddish mama. She worries about me a lot.
Tzadekes.
So I definitely felt that my family were worrying for me. I do think, you know, maybe not as much as I did, because we were in Gaza for 3.5 weeks and then we came out for 48 hours and went back in for another 4.5 weeks. And I did ask myself, you know, is it as smart to come out for those 48 hours? And 2 days before we were, so we didn't actually know we were getting out for 48 hours because, you know, they don't tell you these kind of things because they don't want you to look forward to it. And then something gets canceled and something happens and it doesn't work out. But the week that we got out a couple of days earlier was when Yonatan had been killed. And I think people had gotten into a strong mindset of, oh, I'm in Gaza here. That had kind of been shattered by what had happened. And I think people, at least in my personal experience, when we got out, it was a much needed break. I do know that people found it difficult coming out, and, you know, they found it difficult coming back in. I had a lot of anxiety coming back into Gaza the second time around, and, you know, I spent 48 hours just with my family and my friends and not thinking about anything, and suddenly you're like, oh, I'm on the bus on the way back, and it's like, it was very difficult for me.
I guess final question would be, you've gone through a crazy experience, like something that most of us can't even fathom. Obviously, you've matured and you probably feel like more of an adult than ever before. How has life changed for you? You've still got a youthful edge, but are you still processing what you've been through? Is it constantly in your mind? Do you see images? And how do you feel like you've changed as a person, if at all?
I definitely think, you know, I'm still processing. It's still early on. And they do say, you know, sometimes these things, you know, I don't think I was, you know, shattered by what happened at the beginning. And I wasn't going through a lot of post-trauma or whatever you want to call it. It wasn't disabilitating at the beginning, but they do say, you know, sometimes these things take, you know, it happens 6 months later, it happens a year later. You know, we had a guy in our unit who was in Gaza in 2006, and the trauma from that only hit him now. He had to leave at some point whilst we were in there because way back then, the trauma started coming up again whilst he was in there. So you never really know when it can hit you, and I'm aware of that, and, you know, I think I'm trying to deal with that. In terms of, you know, how life has changed for me or how I'm processing the things that I went through, I try to think very systematically about how life changed for me after being in Gaza. And I think one of the things, you know, when we came out, we had a team conversation and we all spoke and kind of went through the things that we want to leave there and the things we want to keep there to take on with us. And from a lot of the conversations I've had with my teammates in these guardings late at night, these 2 hours, we would have a lot of deep, meaningful conversations. And also just the experience of being there, I think there are a few things that I would keep and there are a few things that I would rather leave in Gaza. One of the things I would like to leave is having regrets about things. And the thing that I wanted to keep was giving my 100% to any mission. And it's a thing that I found personally very important to me in the army and specifically in Gaza because, you know, we have tasks which are taking over a house and finding weapons and finding information about hostages and finding this, that and the other, or finding terrorists, arresting people. And those missions, everyone gives 100% because that's the tachlis, that's why you're there. And then there are the missions, you know, the small tasks that you have to do, whether it's setting up the house and covering the windows or cleaning the bathroom in the morning so you're not living in complete filth, or cleaning up the dishes in the kitchen. And those where people kind of get lazy and they kind of say, oh, someone else will do it and I don't need to do it, it will get done. And coming out of Gaza, for me, it was, doesn't matter what you're doing, give it your 100%. Because the people that the boys loved whilst we were in there were the boys who just didn't ask any questions, didn't say, oh, I don't want to do this, I don't need to do this, it will get done. It was just they gave their 100% to both the things that were important and both the things that seemed less important. And you realize, you know, the best person you can be is that kind of person, I think. It's just doing everything the best way you can do it and giving your 100% to everything and not asking questions about why you need to do it.
Beautiful. Yonah, thank you so, so much for coming in, for sharing your experience with us. And I mean, not much to say other than we hope for peace. We hope that the war will end. We certainly hope that you won't be called back in and that you've had your fair share of the war. You've sacrificed a lot by going and you've risked your life. You've seen people make the ultimate sacrifice. And I think the relevant takeaway for us, or I say us as in the listeners who are not in the army and who are not called in, is that much like you said before, that what got you through a lot of your experience was seeing other people are sacrificing more than you. When you saw the fathers or the people with the jobs or whatever it is, and when you see people who make a greater sacrifice, then it's a chrys, it's a responsibility to make your own. And I think listening to you, you know, with, like I said before, I rehearsed myself speak from, we speak from this cozy room and we've spoken about the war a lot. But hearing your sacrifice up close, I think is a responsibility on all of us to make our own sacrifices, whether it's increasing tefillah, whether it's increasing learning, increasing the chesed you could do. These things seem to pale in comparison to the sort of sacrifice that you made. And I think it's an achrayus on all of us. So thank you very much again. And we hope for good news.
Thank you. And if I can use the opportunity for whoever's listening and whoever is giving their support and, you know, saying the tefillahs and saying tehillim for us, we want to say thank you. I mean, I speak as a collective because I know that everyone who doesn't have the opportunity to do what I'm doing would want to say thank you as well. We feel it and we appreciate your support and we thank you for everything that you're doing for us. And thank you.